Thank you. By show of hands, let's have a look at you. And no, don't go and give five questions in a row. Let's have, if you want to have your little preamble and a political comment, that shouldn't take more than a minute. And then a maximum of 2 minutes for questions. So not more than 3 minutes for anyone. Honourable Alberts, Honourable Montash, Honourable Esterhazen, Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Advocate for the Member for the thorough presentation, also National Treasury for their presentation. It's all very insightful. We're bombarded with information at this stage. I want to go back a little bit to the original intention of this bill. And I want to ask Advocate van der Merwe, in terms of the group of people that we're trying to assist, and we started out trying to identify them. It was a little bit difficult. And it's something that's not thoroughly addressed by the legal opinions from yourself and from Treasury. And it's whether we have a proper set of principles and formula that identifies these groups of people for this type of intervention. That doesn't seem arbitrary. For instance, the 7,500 Rand income per month and the no income, no assets rule that I know that you're asking to be changed, are those, in terms of the constitutional requirements that are set, are those rules and principles proper to give a sure and certain objective? Or does it translate into a sure and a certain objective that would pass constitutional muster? Or is there some arbitrariness in terms of the group of people that we have chosen? And should we not delve into that more deeply to assure that when we do operate on the body, that it's very clearly defined and surgical, if I can put it that way. So that we also know that if there's an effect on the economy, it would be very, very small. Then, just going back into the bill itself, you said that incidental credit agreements should be excluded. I disagree to a certain degree on that point. The reason being that when you apply for credit, they take into account all accounts that you have. It might not be credit accounts, but it might be accounts, it's expenses, let's put it that way. They are expenses, and those expenses can fall into arrears. And then it becomes incidental credit when there is a interest charge and so forth. So I would like to understand why they should be excluded, because they also make up the total body of expenses that would be taken into account to see whether a person is credit worthy or not to obtain an agreement or not. So I do think that they must be included going forward. And that's it for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honourable Montash?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, once we accept the both presentations, Chairperson, I just want the Advocate van der Merwe to just go back and explain to me about the retrospective application of the Act and its implications, and why specific years that she thinks we cannot go into when we do that. And for me, I think the presentation that Advocate van der Merwe has given us today needs to be taken into the draft of the Act as it is, and we look at how far we can go, whether, as she previously said, that there's some limitations on how we can now redraft some areas. That explanation is the only thing I need to pursue. But otherwise, I firmly propose that she includes these proposals into our draft bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Montash. Honourable Esterhazen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Advocate Van Amara. I'm a little concerned if a consumer's obligation under a credit agreement are suspended by court, the consumer is not obligated to perform at all during the period of suspension, and the credit provider would not be allowed to charge any fees or interest during this period. And on page 6 of your presentation, 6 and 8, referring to the citizens and indigents and municipalities, I sit on service delivery meetings on Fridays in Ekurhuleni Metro, and citizens will pay anything but the municipality bills. So for me, that's a little problem. Then on page 10, the impact of the bill. I presume, Advocate Van Amara, you did all the presentations. I don't know if the DG did or something else. But the purpose of, the structure of the opinion, the purpose of this is to promote fair, sustainable, responsible, accessible credit market and to protect the consumers. For me, that is what the impact of the bill must be. The bill must be what the Constitution allow it to be, not what we think it's fair and what we think. Because I think really that if banks will definitely be affected, and if lenders are compelled by legislation to write off even minimal amounts of debt, it would shake the confidence in the South African economy. So we must look at both sides. Then, Madam Chair, if you'll bear with me, the very last page, the other concerns that you mentioned, when arrears credit life insurance is cancelled, then it means absolutely nothing. Then life insurance would mean nothing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Esterhazen. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Advocate Van Amara, as always, and particularly to the National Treasury opinion, which I think is both of them are incredibly enlightening. And it seems like what we are doing is heading towards, which I had hoped from the very beginning, that we would have headed towards a process that actually looks at how do we strengthen the NCA in terms of the original provisions that are there for over-indebtedness, because the Act actually applies for over-indebtedness and deals with it. Does it deal with it sufficiently? Absolutely not, because it asks for the court to make an order, which, as we know, is incredibly expensive and can take a lot of time. And I think, Advocate, that we're heading towards a process of not arbitrarily looking at over-indebtedness, but looking at more of a defined place of indebtedness. But I'm still not convinced on the retrospectiveness of the bill, because I think that where you respond in terms of Pienaar Brothers versus SARS, I'm no legal expert. My sister's an attorney; she got the brains between us. So I chose to become a politician. And I think that the way that the court views money owed to the state differently in the way in which it looks at contractual obligations in terms of credit and the retrospectiveness applicable thereof. And so I'm not convinced that when a legal agreement is entered into between a credit provider and a client that met the prescripts of legislation at that time, that a subsequent piece of legislation can then go and override that, and then the deprivation is considered to be constitutional. I might be wrong, but I still hold that view at this point in time. So I'm not sure if you want to speak to that particular point. Debt relief measures for poorer consumers and a subsidised version of debt relief. I mean, that's something I've been asking for from the very beginning, and believe that that is, you know, what we don't want to do is take people out of the credit market. We want to keep them in the credit market. We want to rehabilitate them because we don't want to exclude them for anything up to, you know, 2 years to 5 years. So I think that that makes a lot of sense, and I think that we've got some work to do on that. Do you think, Advocate, that arbitrary deprivation could be applicable to the category of 7,500 to 50,000? I'm not clear that, I don't believe that that has been defined enough, and there's, you know, there's a lot of research that says, well, if you apply this, you know, band, it becomes less, or if you look at this specific group of people, it becomes more. And it's sort of a debate in this committee as to, is that who we want to apply to? I mean, you remember we started off at 10,000, and I don't even know where 10,000 came from, and then it went to 7,500. And I've never, in myself, satisfied that it is a scientific reason that those are the people that we are speaking to. And so I'm worried that that may be considered arbitrary deprivation down the line. If you just let me move through to I'm just trying to read my notes here. Yes. Then with respect to I get the feeling that you're wanting to drop sort of the asset sort of test, which goes against sort of what I think we had started out in the bill of being a specific no income, no assets. Now we just sort of having this sort of general application of, you know, anyone who sort of kind of says that they can't afford their debt obligation. And I feel that instead of narrowing that process, we widening it under your recommendation under Clause 14 when you want to drop that sort of asset test. Moving quickly along, I still am in support of the NCR being able to suspend suspected reckless agreements. And I tell you why, Advocate, and I said this yesterday and I'll say it again. You know, this process could be a three-year unfolding process. Anyone who has, you know, who meets that criteria could still continue to be burdened by these obligations that they simply can never afford to pay, or where it is genuinely reckless credit agreements. And they are continuously being hammered by the credit providers for that. I think that a mechanism must exist for those agreements to be suspended until such time as they have been adjudicated. So I still will stand in support of that for now. And I would like to make a recommendation, Chair, that I think that and it's a pity that the subcommittee chairperson is not here, and I know he's not well, but I do think that there will have to be amendments made now that we've been able to see more of this information. And I think it would be prudent for the debt subcommittee to meet, to consider this, to consider the amendments, to sit down with National Treasury again at that meeting with Advocate Fanamurva and the DTI and start actually looking at what some of these amendments to the bill would look like. So I would like to propose that to the committee and to yourself.
Thank you very much there, Honourable Macpherson. Mr. Hermans will address the program, which has been revised to accommodate the challenge we've got with the chairperson of the subcommittee being ill, all right? But if I may just look at slide 30. You know, I am concerned. I certainly was not aware that when one is in arrears, this insurance would be cancelled. That's, of course, when you really need it. And I'm wondering, it's Credit Life, of course. when one takes out insurance on cars, you're in arrears, your insurance continues. So I think we may want to engage with the insurance people in that regard. And then on 27, slide 27, that one there, I'm just looking at it as well. Oh yes, the offences and penalties issue. Now I'd be the first to say our courts, criminal courts especially, are already extremely full. So are the, you know, the civil courts. But what worries me is some of the issues that came up here and over the course of since this term and even in the previous term have amounted to fraud. And of course that surely is a criminal offence in the first place. So one would want to have further understanding of how that is going to work. And then we move to slide 16. And this fund you referred to, it was raised, and I was under the impression that this was a treasury fund, but I may have got the wrong idea there. And if you could just explain that, one. And two, it always concerns me when I hear the word money. Is this a money, you know, do we have to then go with national treasury? Is this going to be a money bill or what, depending on where it's located? Thank you. And if you would address that, as I indicated to members and yourselves, we would want to be out of here at about 10 past 12, totally, 5 past 12 even better. Thank you.
Thank you, Jefferson. Thank you, members. If I could start with Honourable Albers' question regarding the 7,500, I think also Honourable McPherson alluded to that. I think that it is necessary for us to perhaps go back to all our presentations and just make sure how we came across the 7,500. I know that there was a bit of a concern at one time, but I do recall a presentation that indicated the 7,500 was the cut-off mark for debt counsellors. That is where they no longer find it profitable to assist a person. The way that the bill, if the bill is amended in the way that I've proposed, I would propose that this is worded in a way that maybe in fact alludes to that criteria. In other words, that we don't use the words after the numbers even 7500, but we use the criteria that informed the 75. So the minister must prescribe if there's a fund or if it is the NCR that will assist, the minister must prescribe the group of consumers that will qualify, and the following criteria will inform the group that qualifies. In other words, then we will say persons who fall outside of the debt review profitability margin. It's very, very bad wording, but that would be the intention of the wording that we will have there. So I do agree. I think we need to go back, make sure that we have that grouping very clearly identified and to understand why we have them. In respect of incidental agreements, I think you've now made the other side of the argument, Honourable Alberts. So it may be something that the committee needs to just look at. I think maybe the DTI can maybe just come and explain to the committee exactly what is an incidental credit agreement, how it will affect a creditor, how it plays into the debt review process. And then from there, we take our cue, and then I think that once the committee is better informed, we can decide whether it's an unfair thing to include it or whether it actually makes sense to make it part of this process. So, yeah, I think I might be convinced otherwise as well. In respect of retrospectivity, if I can, maybe because Honourable McPherson also asked about that, the same question, well, sort of the same as this Honourable Montage. First off, it is not for me or for any council out there to make any decision on constitutionality. And some of the recent constitutional court cases were definitely more equity-based than law-based. So, yes, I cannot with 100% conviction say that this will not be found unconstitutional. But I do think that we have balancing constitutional rights. I do agree with the article of Coetzee that the exclusion of people and not government not making provision for people to undergo some form of debt relief system, whether it's debt review, sequestration, administration, if it is impossible for these people to participate. You know, we've had constitutional court cases that looked at the duty on government to make certain things possible. And I think that would apply here. Government must make this possible. And it won't help if a person's rights are currently being trampled on in that there is no provision. It won't help if you only fix it prospectively. So there is that argument. And in the end, it is for the committee to decide, are we going to go only forward or are we going to say that it will apply? I do think that even your debt review is a form of deprivation of property. And because you are reducing interest sometimes, you're reducing costs, all of those things are part of deprivation. And so having it go backwards, and that is how the Act has been written, made sense because you were addressing people who have been over-indebted at that time and needed help at that time. It doesn't help that you only that you're only able to help them in 3 years' time. They were in need at that time. And that is where the rationale comes in. So I understand that the argument about retrospectivity is that most laws apply prospectively. And the assumption is that a law will only operate from the date that it is promulgated going forward. So it will not affect anything that happened in the past. But it is not a rule that there's no rule, nothing in the Constitution that says civil legislation may not be retrospective. There is nothing in the Constitution that says that. So if we make it retrospective, we need to see what rights are affected. And yes, because it is rights that are being affected before the Act becomes operational, we must be more careful. But on the other hand, all rights in the Constitution can be limited. And we need to simply follow those guidelines. It must be rational, it must be reasonable, there must be proportionality. And like I said, it's not for me to make that decision, and in fact, the bill will in fact also be referred to a council for so we'll get a further opinion on that. But it will not even be for the council that we refer it to 100% say this is constitutional. But if we look at the factors that all play a role, it would be something that we could say, in our view, the Constitutional Court should very likely find it to pass constitutional muster despite the fact that it is retrospective. And I understand that there's a difference between tax and what we are doing here, the fact that this deals with a contract. But there are many examples globally where property is affected in that way, even if it isn't through tax, where it's a restructuring of how something is, how the registration of something works and so on. So it is not that it is something that can never be done. The problem is that we, not the problem, the answer lies in that we need to look at why this is being done. And if that is a justifiable reason, then we need to look at the how. And if the how is fair, is reasonable, there's proportional, you know, what we're doing is proportional, then we will pass that constitutional, in my view, we will pass that constitutional test. Keep in mind that if we go with the proposal, and in fact that is what the bill currently proposed, but if we make it a lot clearer, any consumer who wants to apply for this will first have to try their level best to pass the payment test. It is only if they really cannot pass that test that they will qualify for the suspension. And if the proposal goes that we do it over 5 years, it means that there are 5 years in which the credit provider can still get that money back. Because if this person is going through, and that will hear from Treasury how far that literacy and budget program is, if that is something that that becomes part of what must happen, if that is part of the tribunal's order, then you have someone who's busy being rehabilitated. This person, in practice, will not have been able to pay that debt. So, because this person has now gone through the debt review, the calculations, everything shows that this person is unable to, even in 5 years, even by making 10 rand per month at zero interest, zero cost, will not be able to pay this debt in 5 years' time. So the credit provider will in any event not have gotten any money. The problem that you're sitting with is that consumer stays in that position, and there is nothing that helps that consumer over the next 5 years. The consumer simply has to take the calls from the person who keeps on phoning for their money. So you never get that consumer to start to have a breather. So, okay, I'm going to take these 12 months, I'm going to get myself back up on my feet, and then perhaps after the 12 months. And that is why I think the review is important. There must be a six-monthly review to see what this person is doing, to perhaps look at the training. And all of these criteria are things that we can insert in the bill to make it more, make it very clear where we're going with this, and the fact that we are trying to do the least interference into the rights of someone else. In respect of suspension, and the fact that the credit provider can't charge anything during that time, that unfortunately is the only way to get this consumer back then on their feet. In any event, like I just said, this is a person who really cannot pay anything. The debt review system showed they cannot pay. So the credit provider having to up that interest will only in any event be able to up it up to that to the capital amount, but you're still pushing this consumer into this debt spiral almost, and it is something that then is necessary. In respect of citizens, I'm not sure that I 100% understood the comment. My proposal is that we take the word citizens out. I don't think that it should be there. That was because we looked at indigent and we transplanted that. In respect of the impact, yes, the proposal that I've made considered the impact that the bill would have and tried to minimize it so that we have absolutely as little an impact as possible. So your suspension and your extinguishing will only be in respect of those people who really cannot pay. I'm sorry, I'm just quickly reading through the others. I think I've answered the issue. We do need to identify our group much better. Drop the asset test. It almost sounds like I'm doing drugs or something. To let go of the assets is actually more a practical reason. In fact, while we were talking about assets...
Just a minute. I'm glad we've got quite a few lawyers here. I think you're all aware, if ever something's found wrong, a question members are asked that the judge, presiding judge, applies his or her mind to. Did they apply themselves? We're not applying ourselves if we are talking to each other, which you are not. We are not applying ourselves if we're permanently on cell phones, or almost, let us say in an hour, 15% of the time, 15 minutes in an hour, or 35-40%. That is considered that members did not apply their minds. This is a bill. It's legislation. And we really have got to try and remember that. Please, all of us, thank you.
Thank you. Regarding assets, something that I didn't mention but that I was in fact thinking in the back of my mind is once your consumer goes through the state review process, we need to perhaps look at what requirements are there to look at realizable assets. I'm not sure that is clearly spelled out enough in the Act that the debt counselor should advise the consumer to in fact maybe get a cheaper car. Sell the more expensive car and get a cheaper car. As I understood from the credit regulator, some debt counselors do give that kind of advice. because they're trying to get the person back on their feet. But perhaps that is something that we should actually include in legislation, that there needs to be consideration given to assets that can be realized. So it won't totally take it out. The reason I'm proposing to take it out is that it will simply be an impossible task for the regulator or the debt counsellor to determine whether this person actually has assets, whether they are hiding assets. You know, we will have to perhaps think about sending inspectors out to people's houses to go and see if they actually have assets or not. So that, I think, is perhaps something that we can rather filter into the debt review process, so that assets are considered as part of that process, rather than making it a requirement. Then the issue of the regulator being able to suspend reckless creditors agreements, that is in the end a policy decision, and it's going to be for this committee to consider. The one thing that just came up in the submissions, and that is a bit of concern to me, is if, remember, we have this different calculation. So let's say a debt counsellor does a calculation according to the manual system, for instance, that the regulator might have. The debt counsellor says, yes, this is reckless credit, refers it to the NCR, NCR suspends the agreement. Let's say that suspension happens for ease of calculation on 2 January. Now, the consumer stops paying. Fine, there's no interest, etc., that runs, but the consumer stops paying. Then, a year later, and this consumer in the meantime might be applying for credit, you know, whatever. So this might be taken into account, but currently the consumer isn't paying that amount. So at the end, let's say 6 months later, or that's very quick, I think, the tribunal makes an order and says, no, but this is not in fact a reckless agreement. I've looked at how the bank calculated this, and I'm satisfied that it is fine. Now your consumer is 6 months back in respect of the payment on that. Fine, we can put it in that your payments start again from there, and your interest start again from there, but you've still added 6 months to the life of that credit agreement for this consumer. So it is just something that we need to take account of. It's not just the credit providers that are affected by the suspension. It is also the consumers, especially if that suspension is not upheld by the tribunal. I don't know, perhaps the regulator and the tribunal can maybe propose other methods that could assist. Maybe there could be, the one thing that they indicated was the reporting to be actually to the regulator. We did discuss about reporting directly to the tribunal, but someone has to do the calculations, and that's not the role of the tribunal. But perhaps it is something that can be looked at a bit more to see how that can be sped up. Perhaps it can even be done by internal measures in the tribunal and the regulator, where there could be dedicated staff that deal specifically with something like that. But yes, like I say, it is a policy decision for the committee to take in the end. Regarding amendments, I have started thinking things in my head about how, if we go with the proposal, I think the bill will become much shorter. So a lot of the processes are already provided for, and we can take those out. Mrs. Phelps, about the credit life being cancelled, look, if you are retrenched, that would be the risk that is covered. If you are become disabled, that would be a risk that is provided for. So those will be fine. But the problem is, and I think one of the members mentioned that some companies would say to people, if I don't want to do retrenchment, if you resign, I will give you a 13th check or something, and I'll make it big, you know, and then the person resigns. Actually, they're being retrenched, but it's just the company trying to get around that loophole. Now this person can't make use of the credit life insurance, and if the person then falls in arrears, it isn't a retrenchment situation, so it will lapse. I really do not have an answer, but I do think talking to insurers might perhaps help us understand what can be done there. In respect of offences and penalties, some of the things that we've made offences, for instance, prohibited conduct, there's already currently provisions in the Act that provides, for instance, for the clause that is prohibited to be removed from the agreement. In fact, if an agreement or a clause is unlawful, that whole agreement can in fact be declared void. So So the argument from some of the people was there's already penalties in the act. Why do you make this an offence? You know, why do you further make this an offence? But perhaps it is necessary to unpack each of them and see, you know, what does this entail and should we make it a penalty and should we make it an offence or not? In respect of the fund, yes, it will. If it is a fund that is created through a levy, it will have to be a money bill, and that will be something that National Treasury will have to bring, or rather the Minister of Finance will have to bring. If it is an, by way of your normal budget process and appropriation, then that will simply happen. Well, I suppose it's also a money bill because it happens through the appropriations process. If there's a fund created, it is likely that the fund will reside within. I'm not really the expert on this. I don't know if Treasury can maybe help as well. But as I understand it, the fund will be within the vote that is for DTI. It will just be, you know, identified maybe as a specific item or something. And then whether that is funded through a levy or through appropriations, that is a different question. But yes, it will definitely have to be. This bill will have to make provision for something like that to happen. I've also tried to think about how can we get around so that we maybe make provision for the two ministers to either go the route of a fund or the route of capacitating the NCR or do a combination of both. And I suppose if we play around with wording, we can perhaps call it, you know, the Minister of Trade must in consultation with the Minister of Finance develop a measure that could assist these consumers. And then it is up to the two ministers to decide whether it be a fund or capacity to the NCR or both.
Right, members, it's just 5 to 12. Is there a pressing comment you wish to raise? Question? Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I forgot to mention something. It was flooded with information, so I forgot about this one important piece. I spoke to the Chair about this before. When we look at all the, you know, and all the alternatives in trying to sort this problem out, on page 15 on the National Treasury's submission, they say in the first paragraph, it's not obvious why existing mechanisms for addressing unlawful credit agreements, reckless credit agreements and over-indebtedness would not provide an alternative and less invasive mechanism for achieving the aims. And to a certain degree that is true. I think we might have not have looked at this much further than this committee's own mandate. For instance, the Prescription Act tells us that debt prescribes after 3 years. However, if you look at modern economies like Canada, they only have a 2-year period of prescription. Why aren't we looking at the Prescription Act? There are many other types of debt that's not in a Prescription Act that should be placed in the Prescription Act, because at the moment, for instance, the state is protected for a much longer period on prescription than civil claimants. Why would that be the case? Why must the state be accorded preference above normal civilians doing business? So I think the Prescription Act must be revisited completely to look how we can help these people that we're talking about, that we've identified, and even further in terms of the imbalances that exist in that Act. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Alberts. Honourable MacPherson.
Yeah, thanks. 2 points, and also just to refer to page 15 of the National Treasury's presentation. I can't help but feel, sitting here today, that we've embarked along this process, you know, particularly when they say that, you know, that that measures do exist within the NCA, and yes, they could have been better. And I feel like this sort of process and all the time has could have been avoided, because we've tried to create a bill to deal with inefficiencies in entities like the NCR and NCT. And you know, you can disagree with me and you can say no, but that's my opinion. And I think that, again, I ask from the DTI, when are they going to table amendments to the NCA? because we've asked for it for like a year now, and we still don't have it. And maybe we just need to, you know, immediately embark on another committee bill to address the amendments that need to be tabled. And then with respect to ministerial discretion, I want to make the point that I said back a couple of months ago that 88FC is completely unacceptable. And I'm glad that that all those legal opinions have agreed with that position, despite some of my colleagues to my right insisting on that clause. And I think that it would be very critical that, you know, we immediately, in principle, agree to either scrap that, or that must be scrapped in its entirety, point C, and either to delete that that clause in its entirety, or to make it more specific. But I just, Chair, I just can't get away from this feeling that,
right,
as the previous member for this committee, the Honourable Hill Lewis, had made, that the NCA is one of the most powerful pieces of legislation in government's arsenal, and it has been poorly used by the entities that it was supposed to empower. And I still can't get away from the feeling that this
time
is to deal with inefficiencies in entities.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. It is just 12, if you would do a quick response on those points made, if you wish.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, regarding prescription, that is something that can be followed up with justice. It will fall under the justice portfolio. There's a number of discussions, in any event, that this committee has with justice. We're still looking at the changes to the Insolvency Act, because that might impact what we're doing here. So there's definitely maybe it's something that can be mentioned there. You know, regarding whether time was wasted or not, the development of legislation for committees, or rather, when executive bills come to this committee sees a final product. What happens during the development of that bill is very much behind the scenes. And often you will draft a bill 7-8 times, and all 8 drafts will look very different, because the fact of pursuing a certain direction is the only way for you to understand what the problems are and how to counter them. So, it feels a bit frustrating that we go back to the drawing board, but it's not a fully going back to the drawing board. What is there is, or what I'm proposing, is exactly what the bill proposed. I'm just saying that we need to clearly bring it onto the current system, because we created a separate process for it, and that was not necessary. And that process, in fact, brought its own concerns. If we make use of existing processes, we will still achieve the exact same thing that the bill tried to achieve. The National Credit Act is one of the, if I could say, the better pieces of legislation on our statute book. It does provide a lot. It is lauded globally. So, yes, we should make use of it as we could. Thanks.
Yes, thank you, Advocate Linda Merver. Mr. DG.
Just to issues was raised, so just to make one comment, I would suggest that as we indicated yesterday, we fully support the intention of the bill, which was really to help a low income vulnerable consumers, and in that I think we fully support. But I think given both legal opinions and then the comments from Advocate Van der Merwe, I think if the what we would propose is that we actually accept in total those recommendations, because they are consistent consistent, and I think we should accept it. Then what we will then do is just strengthen the provisions of the bill, which allows, and I think it flows from the earlier point, which I think was made by everybody, that the 2007 Act introduced by the DTI. As you know, it was an extremely progressive piece of legislation because it preceded the financial crisis. And as you know, everybody, including the financial institutions, National Treasury, everybody else, opposed this Credit Act in its initial stages when it was proposed. At that time, as you know, it was opposed by everybody. So, as you know, it is now world-class legislation adopted in the United States after they went through the financial crisis. But why it was important, because it introduced this concept of reckless lending and reckless behavior and over-indebtedness. So what I would maintain is that let's maintain the current architecture of this act. And where some of these amendments are falling foul is because they're deviating from the current architecture of this act. So I think we need to just strengthen some provisions, and especially for this vulnerable group. But I think what I would warn against is remove all parts dealing with finance, subsidies, funds, and money. I think that is not what legislation actually deals with ever. It's going to be the first piece of legislation where you want to propose a fund or a subsidy. You're going to create perverse incentives if you subsidize people to go to debt counselors or to anybody. We see what's happening with lots of pieces of legislation. Don't go into that area. Allow as much power. Give more powers to debt counselors. Give more powers to the NCA to deal with this vulnerable group. And then we can rather contract in debt counselors to do specific pieces of work for us. But it can't be on a subsidy basis because people will abuse the subsidy. And also, you can't control your expenditure if you introduce a subsidy. So I want to say, I warn the committee about entering that area. And let's say any money bills or anything to doing with the Minister of Finance or anything, the DTI will operationalize this. What we've done is a proposal already to employ, and we've made a proposal yesterday. Let us do that. And then we adapt. In every tribunal, when the CCMA was set up, they didn't deal with operational matters. As you know, now it is a... Let the Department of Labor... they dealt with the CCMA. We will deal with the tribunal. We will capacitate as and know the needs. Then we can also subcontract to debt counselors. Certain parts of work, certain areas of the country can be done by them and so on. But I think you mustn't deal with that in legislation. That's an operational matter. But what I would say is let's accept the two opinions from National Treasury and the DTI and then maintain as far as possible. Let's not be too intrusive. Let's not put too many rules in. Let's not overcomplicate the act. Let's keep it simple. The beauty of it was the first, the National Credit Act, we were assisted by Canadians who dealt with the first piece of simple English legislation. That is why this act is so important, because it's drafted in simple, plain English, they call plain English. So let's maintain that, and I think we're becoming too intrusive, we're becoming too operational in this legislation. Let's just give more powers to the credit regulator. Let's give more powers to this particular vulnerable group.
Thank you very much, DG. Honourable Montash, you have a minute.
Thank you, Chair. Not sure I want to respond to Honourable McPherson. Just to say, the people on his right have a right to have a different view from him. And that's why we have legal people to advise us. I also want to tell the country that the DA is the only part in this committee that does not like debt relief. Thank you.
Well, I wouldn't say put it that way, but remember, just a minute. But I do know, as a committee bill, no one, not one party, objected when we delivered this to the House and said this bill was unanimously, not the bill, but the decision was unanimous across parties. But I do want to thank National Treasury for all that hard work. I certainly want to thank you, Advocate van der Merwe, and yourself, DG, and all your colleagues, the DDG, the whole group there, and the National Credit Regulator, the National Consumer Tribunal. Thank you very much for being here. And I'm going to, before I adjourn this meeting, and I would appreciate it if you just sat still, Mr. Hermans is going to give us the revisions on the program. You do know Mr. Honourable Williams is still not well, and he is the chair of a subcommittee on this bill. So Mr. Hermans will just address a revised program. Thank you.
Members, you have received the program and there's some changes to that particular program.
Louder.
The subcommittee on the credit bill will meet on Tuesday next week starting 9 to 11:30. The subcommittee will not meet this coming Friday. The subcommittee will also meet on the 14th of March, which it was originally scheduled as a full committee meeting.
So please make these changes. We issued the CAD program. Yeah.
Then the subcommittee will also meet on the 15th of March, subject to approval by the House Shepherds and the Chief Whip. And then the full committee will meet on the 16th, and it will be a long Friday, Friday the 16th. We've also added deliberations on the 20th of March, as well as the 22nd of March on the committee committee bill. Those are the changes, and we will forward these changes to members electronically as well, and give copies on Friday as well.
What I want to highlight is that we are having deliberations and feedback. What is it on the? Is it the oversight report on sugar? When is that?
That will be on this.
That's coming up
on
the 13th of March. So what should be very, very clear is that on Wednesday the 14th of March, there isn't a committee. Is there a committee meeting? It's only a subcommittee. Let's get that very, very clear, and that is on what we're referring to as debt relief or debt intervention. Is that clear? And again, on the 14th of March, a little bit later, is the Copyright Subcommittee. Right. So on Wednesday, the full committee, as we sit here, will not be meeting. For those of you in subcommittees, please read the rule book which you were all issued. It operates as a committee and has to observe all of the rules. And your report comes then to the full committee to work on. So whatever we, you know how we run things here, and people who come in are allowed in there. The only time we can ask people to leave or not to come in is when we've taken a decision, which we can take, to close a meeting. And that is very, very seldom. I think we've done that for something like interviews and that kind of thing. So I'd like that to be very, very clear. But once again, members, I would like to thank you and to remind you that this Friday we meet 8:30, G26. I've asked Mr. Hermans to try and find a better venue, but he let you know, he'll SMS you. And we are meeting from 8:30 until 12:00. Thank you very much to the departments and also yourself from the legal side and the National Credit Regulator, etc., and members. The meeting is adjourned until Friday.